Okay, girls, today I'm giving you the inside scoop on my favorite place to save this spring. At Ross, it's the spot to get everything you need at prices you'll love. Because when you find brand names for 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices, you'll definitely be finding your next favorite outfit and more. Trust me, you don't want to miss out on these deals on your favorite dresses and tops. And at this price, you might as well throw in a new purse or pair of shoes too. But Ross isn't just about savings. They're about giving back. This year, Ross and their customers raised over $4.1 million to support the Boys and Girls Clubs and local youth programs to help kids and families thrive. Seriously, just visit your local Ross and see for yourself. Because I know you like to keep your closet full and your costs low. So what are you waiting for? Say yes for less at your local Ross.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker?
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%, vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everybody. We are looking incredible in vision today. If you haven't seen us, come over to YouTube and join the fun.
Yeah, it's true. Wherever you are listening to this, we encourage you now to make that jump over to our fast-growing YouTube channel to see us for today's very special Q&A episode in vision.
Today is all about you guys, your questions. We are terrible. We try our best.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we just get overwhelmed with Q&A.
Yeah.
And we need to just sit down and respond to everything.
Yeah.
Today is that day. Anything you've ever wondered about travel, flying, it stops there. Not anything you've ever wondered about anything else.
I was about to say, anything you've ever wondered about us. I'm like, okay, speak for yourself, Dan.
Yeah.
It's not that kind of podcast.
Exactly. That's where it stops. We will be answering those questions today.
Yeah.
We have them all on our phones. Yeah. We're not texting, guys. If you
if you're watching people are being video. People are in touch with us via Instagram. So this is what we've got open. Do you want to kick it off?
All right. I have a question here from Carolina. We're starting off with something more just personal and how we plan our trips.
Okay.
She asks, do you guys always make up your itinerary completely before you go on a trip, or do you just see as you go?
Okay. So
what about you?
Very quick, easy answer is I do not do the itinerary prior to the trip. Definitely not. I know obviously where I'm going in terms of destination. I know roughly the things that I would like to or have to do there, but I am not the one. Despite in every other area of my life, I'm very much kind of type A control freak, super organized down to the minute. When it comes to travel, I don't like the idea of someone presenting an itinerary that says at 11:17, we're going to enjoy, you know, this. And then at 11:25, we've got a break for the bathroom, followed by brunch at 11:30.
What do you mean? This is what I've been doing the past few days. No, I'm joking.
Well, if you have, I haven't noticed
No, we 100% haven't. No, I'm the same. I mean, if by itinerary they mean flight itinerary, then sometimes, Carolina.
Yeah.
But otherwise, no, not
the
a day-by-day itinerary. That feels
my friend, intense. My friend Jassim, he just went on an amazing trip to South Africa. And in fairness, maybe this whole, you know, going down to the minute thing worked because it looked spectacular. But what he showed me was the friend that he was on the trip with had prepared exactly what I had just outlined, literally allocating 5 minutes for, you know, optional bathroom break. And I said, whoa, 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 that's not a holiday. And he said, no, I just kind of relaxed into it and went with the flow. And that's a bit too much.
That wouldn't work for me. I mean, You've noticed I need to go to the bathroom about every 5 minutes.
I don't know how you make it through the episode.
Yeah, me too, actually. I need to go now that you say it. But anyway.
Before you do, I've got a question here from Aaron. Says, hi, Alex. I really enjoy the podcast with Dan. I have a question that I hope you wouldn't mind answering. That's what we're here for. How come there are so many airlines that have self-check-in facilities, yet have their staff at those self-check-in facilities checking people in? He says, surely there is no need for this. I was flying from Singapore recently and saw this happening at the Scoots check-in. If anything, it seemed to make the queue longer. Airlines Aaron have been sold this idea, right, by numerous consultancy firms, by different stakeholders in the industry that have convinced them.
They've been sold by big check-in machine.
Big check-in
automatic machine.
Because I heard, so there's big tech,
yeah,
big pharma,
big boarding pass printer.
Big eggs, right? Yeah. There's currently big eggs in the US. So they've been sold this idea by big check-in, right? Okay. They've been sold this idea that you will cut, you know, check-in times by up to 2/3. And there's these impressive Deloitte-style PowerPoint presentations that show, oh my God, eternal and endless savings. Yeah. Why are we not doing this now? Get rid of the check-in desks and replace it with a check-in desk that's a little bit more vertical and you can walk around it rather than just on one side. And you've saved all this money, airlines. In reality, it doesn't do much at all. More often than not, I think it slows things down because you are empowering the consumer who has no idea how these machines work and need to receive some kind of prior training to put them in front of a machine where they're like, I forgot my name.
Yeah, you know? I take one look at that machine and walk straight by it.
Straight by it. And we are frequent travelers. So yeah. Our advice is, it's that song. Walk on by.
Seriously, we need to take down Big Check-In because...
Big Check-In has an enemy out of the On Air podcast. That's for sure. God, we didn't even know that was a thing until I just wrote the message. Your turn.
So I have a question here from... we've got a question from this guy before and we had the same problem with his name. Poor Bjorn.
Bjorn, I thought we said it
Bjorn.
Was.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Hold on, I thought he's from your neck of the woods. How can you not pronounce
this? This is not a Swedish name, but...
I didn't say Swedish, I said your neck of the woods.
So...
One of the neighbors, no?
Oscar? Basically. He...
Bjorn.
Bjorn. So anyway, his question was not how do we pronounce his name. Let's get that straight.
Gosh.
His question is, what is our favorite frequent flyer lounge by Alliance? So he doesn't count lounges that are not that are accessible if you're flying business or first, Concorde Room, Al Safwa, but specifically frequent flyer lounges in each Alliance, which obviously we need to think about this a little bit. I've had some more time to think since I read the question.
Go on.
Immediately, it's funny, I just got some, you know, anytime I criticize Cathay Pacific's lounges, I get some flack for it. Which is fair. I don't think their business class lounges are amazing on a global scale, but their first class lounges that are accessible by Oneworld Emerald in Hong Kong and at Heathrow, but especially in Hong Kong, are brilliant. They are so nice.
But is that what he meant by the question? Because surely that's an airline lounge.
No. So he's saying it is an airline lounge.
He's not meaning, for example, like the Oneworld lounges that are starting to pop up.
It's specifically that it can't be like Al Safwa where you don't get in Emerald member.
So it must be accessible by flying with an Alliance member.
In economy status.
With status. Yeah. Okay, got it.
So I think in Oneworld, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Honestly, this is going to sound... Oh, never mind. I was thinking... I'm embarrassed. I almost even said it, but I was going to say United Polaris Lounge, which is great.
You just look like you're about to vomit. It was only United Polaris. Like, that's,
but
it's not that bad.
They're not even accessible with status. So, you know, that goes out the window.
Okay.
This is actually a tough question. What's an inspiring SkyTeam option? Do you have any that come to mind in any of these alliances that I haven't mentioned?
Well, obviously in Charles de Gaulle, there are some decent Air France lounge
with Clarence spas
with the spa.
Yeah,
are you able to enter with access if you have status with SkyTeam? Yes, and therefore that's a decent option. I was thinking, and you had kind of answered it when you mentioned Terminal 3 at Heathrow. It's very fun to lounge hop there. The Qantas lounge,
yes,
is great. I don't remember the last time I flew Qantas, but I do frequent in their lounge. Great. Especially in the evening, bit of a buzz at the bar. Very nice space.
Yeah.
So I would enjoy flying on a 1 hour short haul from Terminal 3, perhaps with BA or someone else, but being able to enjoy some Spirit of Australia hospitality before departure.
Okay. I agree. I have another question here. Well, I have a question from Luca. He asks us, I like this, If we could take over an existing airline with everything it has to offer.
Oh, all the assets.
The good, the bad, fleet orders, etc., and turn it over to Glory, which would
choose?
We're
fixers.
We are fixer uppers here to take down Big Check-In.
Who would we choose? Oh gosh, this is the thing with Q&A episodes: is that sometimes these need informed, you know, thinking time prior, and because we make a point in the interest of transparency to not vet the questions, we just bring them up.
Yeah, but you know what I think, guys? When you start submitting your questions, also submit what you think, so we can sort of
balance
get some idea off of that
where
and reflect
where you're thinking.
But I honestly think,
well, first thing, I mean, I don't know how you're formulating this answer, but the first thing I'm trying to do is think about who has something decent on order first. Because of the state of the industry right now, nobody can get anything.
True. And but they could also be
but they could
decent
have
already.
Yeah. So that's true.
Okay. Honestly, I'm trying to think, it needs to be an airline in a...
Okay, I've got my answer.
I don't know what you were going to say, but I was going to say Qantas.
No, I wasn't.
The reason is that they have such a powerful position in Australia. So competitively, they're quite good, well-positioned in that sense. Mm. There's a lot of potential improvement. They're already quite good in many ways, but there's a lot of exciting improvements I think you could make to make the experience even more fun by taking influence from airlines in Europe that do that successfully, that we bring up all the time, in my opinion. Finnair, Virgin Atlantic, the ones that, you know, they can't afford to go for luxury, so they go for a more fun experience, that kind of thing. I think it would be fun to do Qantas.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I would choose, I mean, considering we haven't discussed where the funding would come from, but it would be interesting to take one of the main Chinese carriers and then have them emerge as the airline to rival Singapore Airlines and just throw everything at it. Strategically, that could work. I don't know who I would choose. I think maybe China Southern. You're inheriting a decent fleet. You're inheriting aircraft that have only recently been delivered as well.
Yeah.
The other obvious answer I was going to suggest, of course, was one of the US carriers. The key part being the fixer-upper part.
Maybe even just take Delta and make it even better, you know?
Yeah.
Even better, but
I would just make it better.
Or Air Canada. Why not?
Air Canada is a good one. Air Canada is a good one.
They're actually very similar to Qantas in many ways.
Very true.
In how they, in the, you know, their position in the Canadian market.
Yeah.
A lot of political power in Canada.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
UPM now.
Yeah, exactly.
Former Bank of England governor knows his numbers.
Yeah. Actually, an interesting example. And also, Canada doesn't have the problems that Europe has. Yeah. Not that it's a problem for consumers, but for airlines, of low-cost airlines just pulling down fares like crazy. So that's interesting. I think when it comes to China, Hainan Airlines is the closest we've had to an airline trying to distinguish itself in China.
For me, it's a confused airline.
Yeah, I've never actually flown them. No. And obviously, Skytrax, we've said a lot about that. Yeah. There are, or at least were, a five-star airline, but... Yeah, it hasn't worked so well.
Yeah. Turkish would be interesting as well.
Yeah, actually, because they also, although they're good, have a lot of untapped potential in terms of onboard experience, especially hard products.
I've got a question from Sean. He says, "Hi, Alex, have you ever come across airport security confiscating liquids under 100 mil? I was traveling from Belfast to London Stansted. At security screening, they confiscated my 75 mil shaving foam and 75 mil moisturizer as they said it didn't pass the swab test. Surely this puts new questions on the 100 mil liquid rules at airports. The same Gillette shaving gel has been in my liquids on other flights and has been screened at Heathrow, Gatwick, Doha, Dubai, Tokyo and Bangkok without any issues. So why was it taken? I mean, have we ever come across a liquid that hasn't, quote, passed the swab test?"
That's crazy.
I haven't. No,
no, me neither.
No. Stansted, why is it not passing awful the swab about this? Test. I know this didn't happen at Stansted, but Stansted were awful about the whole, you're not allowed to have two liquids of the same. Did you know that? this like is not
the exact
uniform.
Same product.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
But then there's a question mark because, of course, they don't know what's in. You're able to say, oh, it's not moisturizer in there, it's shampoo.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can refill from home.
Yeah.
You can take the refillable bottles, which are far better use of it.
All. Yeah.
And then, of course, it all looks, how do they know what's
that's in such
it?
A random rule.
Yeah, it's so bizarre how they apply these rules. I haven't, to answer your question, Sean, I haven't come across that prior about it not passing the swab test. But I think if I was in that situation where they say, you can't because it hasn't passed the swab test, I don't think there's any other option other than you let them take it.
No.
I know that's what you did. So that's that. On that, you remember a while back we had the I've had it segment where we said what we've had it with. Somebody replied saying, I've had it with people who spell Stansted.
Yes.
S-T-E-A-D rather than S-T-D. S-T-E-D. Goodness. I was thinking of Stansted, that's why.
Oh my God, it's too perfect. Guys, from now on, we spell Stansted. We abbreviate Stansted, S-T-D. That should be the airport code.
I'm sure it was a suggestion. For obvious reasons, it wasn't.
And Luton should be LSD, just because...
Well, okay, well, I want to clarify, Sean did spell it correctly.
Yeah.
But it reminded me of the,
just
segment
speaking
and the
of
feedback
funny,
we had.
Speaking of funny airport codes, this could be a whole episode, but just one that comes to mind that I always crack up about is Gaia in India, which has the airport code GAY. G-A-Y. I mean, there's so many funny ones, but I'm always like, you know, especially when we're in Bangkok, I always see there's, I forget which airline flies from, anyway, from gay straight to BKK.
That's
all
funny.
Right. I have a question here, and I feel like we've spoken about this, but this comes up even from friends. I have them getting into literal altercations about these kind of situations. Okay, I don't know this guy's name, but he asks, every long-haul flight demands I choose the window. Well, I guess he chooses the window. And it often becomes a conflict. I even got shouted at by crew once on Finnair, of all airlines.
Do Finnair crew even know how to shout?
Yeah, I feel like they would be
no,
like,
no, they do. One
Sir.
Of them was rude to me about, do you remember when I took Demi to the forward bathroom because she was
oh, right,
not feeling
within
well.
Europe. Yeah.
In Europe, yeah.
I just feel like they smile and offer you blueberry juice. That's my experience.
Mostly.
How would you approach it if you got firmly asked to close the blinds?
Oh, this is about closing the blinds.
Yes, exactly. Okay, okay. That's what he got shouted at.
Okay, okay.
Do I start demanding money for the seat back from airlines because he ordered a window and they forced him to close it?
Mm. I would say that you don't go down the money route.
No.
I don't.
That's
because
not
they're not
work.
You're not buying a window view. You're buying a seat located next to the cabin wall of the fuselage. And sometimes, as many people know, there is no window there because the natural layout and design of the aircraft, maybe it's at the fuselage join bit where two bits of fuselage are together and therefore there is no window there. So don't go trying to find a refund. But I am advocate number one for being able to allow natural daylight into the cabin as long as it's not the crack of dawn. Or a 12-hour daytime flight whereby it's inevitable that they need to somehow create some kind of darkness in order to adjust for jet lag. I have said time and time again, for example, the ideal flight where I think you should be able to enjoy daylight, if so, is if you are departing Europe, like London or Paris, at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and you're flying west to New York or Montreal for a 4 p.m. arrival, and the flight is only 6 hours, sometimes even less, then I think you are able to have that window shut up.
Yeah, I think it's a problem because on U.S. carriers, crew can get quite difficult. But this is just, I had some friends who flew Emirates recently. Yeah. They were in economy. I think they had the seat in between them empty. So one was in the window, one was in the aisle. Across the aisle from them was an Emirati. And we know that on Middle Eastern airlines, it's sort of rule of the local. And the Emirati demanded to the crew that they close their window shade, our friends.
Yeah.
So the crew asked them, they refused. because it was a daytime flight. They wanted to look out.
Yeah.
So then chaos ensues because the crew doesn't know what to do. This guy kept telling, he didn't want to confront them directly, but he kept telling the crew, I want them to close it. I want them to close it. Our friends didn't budge, which I think is the right thing to do, because who's this guy to tell you to close your window shade?
Well, that is
He's in the middle of the cabin, not even in your row.
Yeah.
I think
the amenity kits, even in economy, most of them include the eye shade.
Exactly.
If you want darkness to
sleep. If you want someone to do something, ask them politely instead of telling the crew, can you order them to close their window kind of thing. So my take is that you push as much as you can without getting rude. If someone says, can you close it? I'd really appreciate if I could keep it open, please. I want to look out. If they keep pushing, eventually, I wouldn't just keep objecting until it becomes hostile, because that's unnecessary. But I think this is abused. This is why we don't like the 787, because the crew are
exploiting.
You know, they're the window dictators who choose when the window is locked or not.
Seriously.
It's a frustrating situation that we have all been in. And it's just about, you know, fighting for your rights.
This is an interesting concept question. This is from an Instagram account called The Airport Aviation. And he or she asks, if you could change the configuration of an existing aircraft, what would you pick and why? They say, I'll go first. I would remove the first few rows of business class on the Etihad A350-1000 and introduce a downsized version of the residence. The mini residence would have a living room on the port side, an ensuite bathroom with a shower, yes, a shower, they say, on the starboard side, and a double bed in between, and a downsized version of the lobby. Goodness, you're running out of space on the whole aircraft. The one that's found on the A380 to be used by first and business class guests located just behind the mini residence. I would do this because I want to expand the luxuries found on big aircraft like the A380 on smaller airframe, such as an in-flight shower. It's a great little, you know, discussion point, because one thing I think that this will actually lead to in terms of discussion is that social spaces and unique spaces on commercial aircraft are now under threat as we lose aircraft like the A380. And I think where airlines are investing in, and splashing the cash on big luxury cabins, they're realizing that the social spaces don't actually make money, and so they're thinking, we don't need it. And that's a sad development, because it is still unique. If you are, perhaps it's the flight that you have saved up your whole life for, and to be able to leave a business class seat, for example, and walk over to a bar or lounge is so unique and such an enjoyable experience that it is sad that that will probably cease to exist once all these A380s are gone and we're with 777s forever and ever and ever.
I mean, airlines need to do what's most economical, obviously. Yeah. But there is... Etihad is also one of those that's a bit confused about first class, specifically Etihad. But if there is an aircraft... he asks us what we would change, right?
Yeah.
I would change...
I'd reposition Emirates' bar. I've always said that. I think
from the back of the
A380. Qatar's A380 bar is in the best spot on the A380 of any aircraft, of any airline, globally. The fact that there is no passing traffic.
Yeah.
Because I hate sitting in a restaurant where a waiter, you know, has that brisk walk really fast, very, very close by you, because they're in a rush. It's like, I'm not supposed to be part of that. I actually had to tell a waiter the other day, because she was running up and down like a lunatic in this place that was super expensive and it was impossible to get a reservation at. And she kept cutting the corner to get round to the other side and brushing past my friend, who was looking every time it was happening.
Yeah.
And I just said to her, sorry, slow down.
Yeah.
And so the same thing happens on an aircraft with the Emirates bar, because the Emirates bar is located right next to the rear galley.
Yeah.
And the crew bunks?
Okay, I don't know about the bunks, but...
Or are they on the main deck?
Yes, on most A380s from Emirates, they are. In defense of that layout, I will say that it's great to have the bar and the lavatories back there, because having seats, keep in mind there's doors back there, and some airlines even cram in a row or two behind those doors. Actually, all other airlines do.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a dead, dark space without many windows. Etihad, for example, has like two rows of business there. I flew in that seat on their A380 business, and there's one window in the first row, and that's it, because then you're too far back.
I forgot that Etihad have that, yeah.
Yeah, so using that space,
yeah.
I think it's, you know, if you're going to put it somewhere, it's not a bad place. But yeah, I mean, gosh, there's so many. I would just say, add more business class. We want more seats to choose from with our points and all that kind of stuff. This is good. This is something I've been eyeing that we haven't spoken about. But Sean asks a question for the podcast. So with Thai Airways receiving new A330s, A330-300s from Virgin Atlantic, they rebranded Virgin's older product. What do you guys think about airlines rebranding old products as, quote, brand new and revolutionary?
Oh.
I especially hate the Thais saying the Virgin's old herringbone seats are great. Love the pod with you and Alex. Best wishes. Did you know about this?
No.
Oh,
so. No, so that's interesting.
Obviously, Virgin Atlantic are getting rid of their A330s.
I knew that Thai were taking them. I knew that.
Right, okay.
I didn't know that they were branding it as new and revolutionary.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
I haven't seen that. I have seen them branding the premium economy as something cool, which Thai doesn't have on their other aircraft.
Yeah.
So that's unique.
Isn't it funny? They're just inheriting something.
I know. But this is a problem all over the industry right now because of the aircraft shortage.
Yeah, so the chronic aircraft shortage is leading to airlines. The only way they're able to do anything is to take from the second-hand market. The rates are the highest they've ever been.
Yeah.
And of course, you're getting someone's sloppy seconds.
Especially in this case when Virgin,
yeah,
as we know, their old herringbone business class is not necessarily a fan favorite.
Yeah.
And people in the UK are, of course, very excited to see these aircraft phased out in favor of A330neos with beautiful, more standard, staggered business class seats. Thai is an airline with an incredibly varied fleet, actually not too unlike Korean Air, with, you know, a different type of seat on their 787-9 compared to their 787-8. Vastly inferior on the Dash 8, very good on the Dash 9. So to see them add another A330 configuration is, of course, disappointing. But Thai, we know they placed a huge order for the 787-9.
Nine, yeah.
I think that is what they're hoping will reinvent their fleet. Perhaps, hopefully, this is a temporary solution, at least when we're talking flights outside Asia, because these are being used to India on flights that can sometimes reach 5 hours or so, which actually isn't that long. But yeah, I wish we didn't see this, but we see this quite a bit, and it's because of the state of the industry.
Yeah. I've got a question from Anna. She asks, can you dive into some examples or an example of an airline that is relied upon for more than just connecting from A to B, but not, she's put in brackets, but not an airline, for example, that's in a remote mountain village in Kathmandu. She's speaking more on a bigger scale. I read this and an airline came immediately to my mind and I wanted to break it down. So in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, you have the Azores. The Azores remain pretty unknown to a lot of people. I mean, there are a lot of people that are simply unaware of the existence of these beautiful islands, Hawaii of the Atlantic, if you like. And I have been a few times. It is Portuguese overseas territory. And aviation is incredibly relied upon, not just obviously to connect from A to B, but also to C to D and to all of the other islands. But I saw this firsthand with just how much they rely on anything slightly major in terms of medical, in terms of importing medicines, in terms of accessing and ensuring the smooth flow of everything from the mainland, so Portugal and Lisbon and the hub of Lisbon, across to the main island and the main hub of the Azores, which is Ponta Delgada, and then redistributing it across Ponta Delgada to the other islands. So I thought, okay, in that sense, they really rely on SATA, Azores Airlines, to play their role in ensuring that everything arrives to the islands in order to serve the community there. And it is more of a public service than it is searching for profitability. At the same time, given the unique location of the Azores in the middle of the Atlantic, the Azores plays a massive role in commercial aviation, in being that diversion point.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of those transatlantic routes. Again, whether it's medical because of an onboard medical emergency, tech related, they've had a glider, an aircraft with a double engine failure, land successfully from a flight over the Atlantic.
Air Transat.
It was. So it really serves the aviation industry both naturally and for its community with how it operates as an airline on the public service side, but also, of course, as an airline to connect the world with Azores and vice versa.
Good input. Of course, we're seeing over the past weeks and months, since the Airbus on A321 fire, how airlines are starting to question
that was here in South Korea.
Power banks. Yes. So Matthew writes a long question with some very flattering words. But basically, he says, have there been discussions as to how airlines will treat power banks and how passengers can carry and store it? Or does there need to be some sort of discussion regarding policies related to power bank usage? On the topic of electronics and bags, a few days ago, a passenger on a Philippine Airlines flight complained that their laptop was damaged by PAL. The thing is, they put their laptop in their checked luggage, which is something that airlines don't allow.
Yeah.
I wanted to know your and Alex's take on this. I'm kind of surprised about it because for me, who'd put something as valuable as a laptop in their checked baggage, knowing it'll probably get thrown around? I can't help but wonder if they thought of doing this for attention or something. But could this potentially signal a need for airlines to be more stringent in checking that no one places their electronic in checked luggage? So let's start with the power bank thing.
Okay.
Here in Asia, there's, I would say, a concerning development, which we don't know if this will be permanent or not. But following the Airbus something, we're seeing more and more airlines, as far as Thai Airways, a 6-hour flight from Korea, banning not only the charging of a power bank on a flight, but even using a power bank while in flight. We're seeing other airlines prohibit passengers from putting a power bank in the overhead bin. You have to have it on your person at all times while you're on the flight.
What about if it's in your bag?
By your seat.
In your bag, under
accessible.
The seat.
Yeah, that's fine. But to me, this is, I mean, I always travel with a power bank. What about you?
It's necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, the phone doesn't last.
So what happens if you're on an airline? I mean, I was on Etihad's A321neo a few months ago.
Yeah.
Taken from Bamboo Airways, secondhand. So not the LRs. These aircraft don't even have power ports or USB in business class. And I was on a 4-hour flight. So the only thing keeping my devices alive, because I didn't have anything else to do besides read a bit, was my power bank. What happens now if airlines all over the world start banning power banks?
And you know that aviation is incredibly fragile. It only takes one thing like this to have happened for us to see a quick knee-jerk reaction from across the sector.
Yeah, but I just feel like power banks have been around for over a decade. Most people have been traveling with power banks for a long time already. So having one incident now causing airlines all over the, at least Asia so far, saying you're not allowed to use power banks on board, I feel like it's a bit of an overreaction, to be honest. What about you?
I think there needs to be better understanding of to ensure that these power banks are not, for example, squashed in the backpack.
Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of what we understand starts to set them off. Just ensuring that, there is that understanding. How you extend that understanding to a society, we're talking of billions of people.
Yeah.
I don't know. Exactly. And that's why aviation, rather than get the education message across, it tends to just revert to, right, it's banned.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult in aviation to get anything that has been banned lifted again. We are still doing things 25 years after 9/11 that came into practice as a direct response to 9/11.
Yeah.
The industry knows that it's really, really safe, that it doesn't want to fix what's not broken, and it perceives that to not be broken.
But part of this issue is probably, let's be honest, cheap power banks. There are some that don't have the proper safety mechanisms.
True.
Aren't
made
correctly.
You can pick them up in dodgy markets. And
exactly.
Anyway.
It's like you buy a cheap wall charger or a cheap cable. Those are also fire hazards.
Yeah.
So perhaps there needs to be a certification for power banks to make them airplane eligible, for example.
Who's going to check that?
But think about, in security, all liquids have to be taken out of your bag. So yeah. Some airports already require you to take out your power bank. If you then have that and there's some way either for the machine to detect, we're talking obviously the future.
Come on.
Or, I don't know. Or
look at the pandemic. We were drowning in QR codes that didn't talk to each other, you know?
I don't know. But there needs to be something like that because we can't just have airlines banning the usage of power ports, in my opinion. For the second part of Matthew's question, just quickly, no one should possibly be checking or valuable electronics in their checked bags.
Yeah.
And I think, airlines can't be more stringent, like he's asking, because they can't manually search through everyone's bags. But also, airlines are not, they're not liable, right? If you're if the bag is damaged, yes. But if the bag on the outside is whole.
No. And you shouldn't be checking in anything valuable.
It's like you check in a fine glass vase.
And then you're surprised that it's not in one piece on arrival.
That's not the airline's fault. Yeah. And people try to put fragile tags on their bags.
No, it means nothing.
Which means nothing.
Fragile is a mere, those big stickers are a gentle, tap on the shoulder to the baggage handlers. And guess what? They've seen 10 million of them that day.
Yeah. And it's more like they see it and they go, I want to throw this out. I want to throw this to be extra aggressive.
Hopefully that's not the case, but we don't know. This is from Jack. If supersonic travel makes a comeback, will it actually be affordable or will it just be a rich person's flex?
Rich person's flex.
Yeah.
It will be at least the price of first class.
At least the price of first class.
Yeah.
Because
you're
paying to literally be able to be somewhere in half the time. So I don't see how. It won't be anywhere near as competitive as what business class is these days in terms of the low fares that you're able to obtain. I don't think you'll be able to use miles and points on supersonic, at least not in the first 5 years, if it survives 5 years. So yeah, that's the quick answer to that.
Yeah. So Kevin, this is quite an interesting intellectual discussion because he points to White Lotus and basically how, we know this, people, I feel like especially wealthy people do this where they say they've traveled somewhere. I've been to Japan or I've been to Thailand, but they'll go stay at one Four Seasons resort.
And never leave.
Never leave and be like, oh, I love Thai culture.
Worst
I love
kind
Thai
of travel.
People. Yeah. It's obviously not.
It's just a humble little breaking news.
Exactly. It's not real travel. So he's asking, well, it's not real cultural travel, I guess. So. Kevin asks, aren't airlines also kind of doing the same thing? It's like how you can't say you've been to a country if you've only transited at their airport.
Yeah.
Flying with Emirates or Qatar doesn't make one feel like experiencing an Arabian escapade, but neither do their hub airports. Can customers choose who they want to fly to experience a different culture on board and in transit like a tourist? Can this issue be addressed?
Transit at the airport.
Or should it? Yeah.
Well, I think Doha have addressed this big time because now you've got a souk in the airport.
Really?
Have you not been to Souk al-Matar?
No.
It's like Souk Waqif.
Where is it?
It's located just parallel with, where Small Lai is, the cause, which is at gate C13. You know what that is? On the other side to it.
Okay.
So the end of the sea concourse. At the end of the sea. So the teddy bear's behind me.
Yeah.
I walk past the sea concourse, all the way.
Yeah.
Or I take the train, come downstairs if I've taken the train or continue straight if I've walked. Before you go around the rotunda to go into the orchard, on the left is the souk. It opened last year, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah. That is a really nice. And you can sit in the traditional seating. It's not gimmicky either. It's been done really, really well. Mm. And you definitely get the real Middle East experience there.
Nice.
That's just in that souk then. And there's a restaurant of not just Middle Eastern food, not even just Khaliji food, but of Qatari food, which is a very specific cuisine, part of a specific branch of Khaliji food. And so that they've put in effort to bring Arabian culture there. Because you're right, many airports,
you don't know where you are.
There's a massive Louis Vuitton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love Finland and Helsinki does this a little bit. Right, yeah. With the Moomin shops. And you just kind of...
The vibe. It looks at the design, the
exactly.
sounds.
And also, you know, in the non-Schengen area, they have that... It's like a nature immersion spot. It's not really nature, but you can sit on a bench and there is like sound coming from all directions with bird song and rivers. And you see...
That was hyped up way more than when I experienced that. I was like, is this it?
Okay, I didn't see anyone hype it up, which is why maybe I was like, okay, this is cool.
All right, I found it a bit
It's obviously not a mind-blowing experience, but I like that. I've never been to Souk Al-Matar, but I'll have to go next
to
time.
Souk Al-Matar.
But Souk-Matar, it's true that most airports don't very
Do you know what Matar means in Arabic?
Airport.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look at me. Yeah. Al Khutut, Al Jawiya, Al Qatariya. Okay. The moral of the story is yes, airlines can do it more.
Yeah.
Of all airlines in the world, I think Middle Eastern airlines, perhaps also Ethiopian, are the best at bringing in elements of their culture to welcome people in because, yes, Emirates doesn't really, Qatar a bit more, but especially if you fly with Oman Air, at least back in the day. You just
not
feel...
Not now, they're taking a sledgehammer to passenger experience.
But the boarding music, being welcomed on board with lemon mint and Arabic coffee
the
and...
scent, the amouage scent, Armani brand.
Yeah, all of those things make it very clear we're not in Kansas anymore, you know?
No,
you,
we're not.
You step on board in Munich and you go, oh, wunderbar, this is like the Middle East. So, good stuff.
I thought you were about to say like in Munich where you step into the Lufthansa lounge and you're greeted by big ass
pretzel. That doesn't, I don't know if that
quick one from Emma.
Germany, but.
Guys, do airlines actually care about their sustainability targets or is it just PR to keep the regulators and passengers happy? For many airlines, it's just corporate rubbish.
Yeah.
I think there are genuinely some airlines that care and that have invested to ensure that they, I think IAG make excellent strides in it.
And I think they
really are. I think BA is putting in, it hasn't all come to fruition yet. It's not all on the surface yet, but they've made big, big strides in the production and the investment in production of sustainable aviation fuel, in their choices where it comes to passenger experience, onboard service, the materials that they're using. I know I'm aware of some future projects that are coming up that are very sustainability focused. And also, BA have a very decent way, led by their sustainability team, of being able to recognize what is BS sustainability only done for PR and what actually matters and will matter for the passenger when they realize that, they didn't just offer me to, you know, offset and then shake your hand and bye-bye.
Yeah.
Instead, there was that effort to, for example, IAG used as last year, used every drop that they could get their hands on of sustainable aviation fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if they were able to help in the production of it, we as passengers would all benefit from a lower carbon footprint. So BA is directly, along with IAG, but specifically BA, directly investing in that production. To get production up, Rome wasn't built in a day though, so these things take time. But for a lot of airlines, what about the airlines that don't even mention it? I mean, there are airlines that pretend the S word doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is crazy. But then again, I think outside of Western Europe and perhaps some airlines in North America, no airline is really, that's not their priority as far as I feel. But certainly Western Europe.
And I get it because there's not loads of tools to offer passengers.
Yeah. And it's public pressure, but it's also that the people who work at the airlines are a result of the place where the airline is based. So Scandinavians care a lot about sustainability. At least they used to. I mean, I hope they still do. So therefore, SAS cares a lot about sustainability.
Talking about the region as if he hasn't set foot there in 10 years. It's like, I hope they still do.
I come home and I'm like,
call your family and find out. They live there.
I know. That's a discussion for another day. But anyway, it's been a pleasure, as always, doing some Q&A with you.
We still didn't get through all of them.
I know. I'm like
I've
horrified.
I've still got about 15 here.
Yeah.
I think because at least we're not giving the short form answers. We're trying to be as insightful as possible, and therefore it takes time. But
exactly.
Look, we'll do another Q&A episode sometime soon, and we will carry across those questions either into the regular episodes that we do Q&A at the end, or if not, then into the wider Q&A episode.
Exactly. So on that note, I guess all we can say is we will see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.